This is the first event that the new seniors ministry organizational team has put together. So we're really excited to have so many people come out. We're going to be discussing advanced directives. Rich Gauntney is here from Transitions Life Care. He is the community engagement representative for Transitions Life Care, which used to be Hospice of Wake County. He has over 22 years of experience serving in nonprofit organizations in both education and spiritual care. Rich received his graduate degree in educational leadership from Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio in 2000. Most recently, he and his family returned from a five-year adventure in Malaysia, where he served as a spiritual life director at an international school. He has a lifelong passion to engage people of all ages concerning the issues that matter most in life. And this is one of those issues, advanced directives. So we welcome Rich.
Thank you. I'm going to use the microphone. This will help us make sure we're heard clearly. Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for coming out today. In what feels like the first day of spring, but it's still winter. Very honored to be with you. And, you know, this is not the first time I've been here. I was just telling the leadership team, this ministry, which also invited, extended an invitation to me last year to come to the care chair. I want to make sure I get those correct. Because tonight I'm going to an event called Share to Care. So I want to make sure I get them right. But I really wanted to let them know that I talk a lot about this church in, as an example of how we do community engagement at Transitions. Because our goal is really to go deeper in relationship with community groups rather than just show up and share one message one time and then maybe you'll hear from us again the next year or another time. They extended the invitation to have us come for a series of conversations that launched on a Sunday morning here between services and then went into a three-part series on the midweek, and that went really well. And then again, to have an additional invitation to come and to be a part of this conversation today is just really an honor. So I share your story because that's really our goal. I tell people I love what I do because I don't have to sell anything and I don't have to ask you for money. And that's usually, you know, people are glad to see you then. I would really want to really offer you a presentation, but really engage you on a conversation that really would need to take place outside of here with the people closest to you and to those who you love and those who would be most affected. Again, if something changed in your life story as far as a diagnosis or an ability to speak for yourself. And these are, and really, that's really kind of the big goal, is to change your conversation. It's not just about the documentation. Documentation is important, but the documentation allows us to start to have the conversation with the people around us, and those are the issues truly that matter. Well, a little bit more about me before I launch into our story and what we're going to talk about today. For a little over 23 years now, I've worked in the nonprofit field, as Margie mentioned, education, ministry, spiritual care. I've been married for 23 years, have two children, a 19-year-old freshman at Gardner Webb University over in Bowling Springs, North Carolina. And I have a 16-year-old son in high school in Orange County. And as I always say, yes, that's a prayer request, because I have two kids, one in college, and one 16-year-old boy. But I want to just say that, you know, when we landed and returned from Malaysia just a little over 4 years ago, things didn't quite pan out the way that we thought and where we were coming back to. And just long story short, really since then, God literally transplanted us here through the gift of the home until we got worked out what we were going to do, and then the job. And I was working with United Way, sending out speakers to go and share about different nonprofits in the areas. And every time I would send a speaker from what was then Hospice of Wake County, people would start to cheer, both at United Way and in the community groups. So it made me think, what's the Hospice of Wake County? Well, long story short, the door opened up for me to come into this role, And my approach, having zero health or medical background whatsoever, was to come in the front door and wrap my head, my heart, my hands around the message of who we are and what we do. Not just to memorize a mission statement or to memorize a set of information, but to come in, to wrap myself in around me, and then to go out and help translate that message into the community. Well, one of the misperceptions about hospice and end-of-life care that I recognize is that too often people equate hospice with death and dying. When you look closer at it, in reality, it has more to do with life and living. One of the biggest obstacles to people wanting to call or reach out to hospice is they feel like they're giving up hope. But what we like to say, and a lot of folks who work and do the things we do would say, is that in reality, you're not giving up hope. But when your hope transitions, especially as it pertains to hospice care proper, from cure to comfort, and what makes quality end of life, what is quality of life for you at every stage as a diagnosis or a prognosis changes, and for people to make the most of the time they have. Well, because people equate hospice with death rather than life and living, we came up with the idea, how do we get out to the community and engage and have and change the conversation, not just about hospice, but about life. And what we started to realize is that people were ready to have these types of conversations. So the idea was to get people to have these talks or to come up with different subjects, because we know that we're going to die. The question is, how can we make the most out of the time that we have? So we started to put together a series of presentations, of which we've done a few here, both for book discussions to talks about grief and loss to anything we can do, caregiving resources and other pieces. But this talk we're going to have today is one that my very first year I had to over 3,000 people in 1 year. And that was people who were just ready to have a talk about their wishes and advanced directives, but also to hopefully challenge them to make the most of their lives and the time that they have. And that's really where my passion and gift mix came in, was to creatively take that conversation to the community. And that's really what brings us here today. Well, let me just tell you briefly, for those of you who've been in Wake County for a number of years, we like to give the reassurances, even though we just changed our name a few years ago, we like to underscore why, so you understand what it is that we do. Because nothing's really changed other than what we call ourselves. Back in 1979, our hospice of Wake County was founded when one of this area's first oncologists, Dr. Billy Dunlap, when his patients reached a place where cure was no longer an option, and now he called for comfort and care for the patient and the family, he did something about it, started a nonprofit hospice, had two part-time nurses who were volunteer their first year, and they served six patients that first year. Fast forward to 2016, we have over 350 employees, over 400 volunteers, and we'll serve over 5,000 patients this year alone through different areas of service. So what happened is, as we grew, not only where we served changed and grew, but what we did. So not only do we serve Wake County, I like to tell people this, we are centered and hubbed in Wake County. That's where our physical location is. But because most of hospice care and the services we offer take place at home, where people, their wishes typically are to be at home surrounded by the people they love, well, we serve more than Wake County. Durham, Johnson, Franklin, Harnett, parts of Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Orange County, even into Chatham County. So people wouldn't think to call hospice of Wake County in those counties. But we also offer more than hospice. We offer caregiving resources through Transitions Guiding Lights. If you're on a caregiving journey, a loved one close to you has gotten ill, a chronic illness, or that you now have been thrust into the role as caregiver, there are resources available, vetted, quality resources to refer you to in the community. There's home health, palliative care, hospice proper, and then grief and bereavement, which is free to anyone, one-on-one or small group. If you've lost a loved one who's died, you can receive free counseling, one-on-one or in small groups to do that. So you can see a little bit why we changed our name. We weren't purchased by anyone. We're still a nonprofit. We raise a lot of money to keep one promise that launched us into existence, is that no one should ever be turned away due to an inability to pay. And they never have, and we never will. And we believe everyone deserves the highest quality care at end of life. But this conversation today has to do with, as we seize the moments now, to communicate our wishes, but also to really cultivate a lifestyle of leaving nothing unfinished, unsaid, or undone in our lives. And that's really what launches us into this conversation today. Well, advanced directives. The simplest way to look at what an advanced directive is to look at the word itself. They really are what they say they are. They're directions written in advance, created to regarding your future medical care for yourself. They're used only when you're unable to speak for yourself. This is different than an estate plan. It's different from, we're going to get into some detail there about what that has to do with, but they're only activated when you're unable to speak for yourself, or if a doctor, as long as you are conscious and able to make decisions for yourself, you're able to direct your health care. But at the point that you cannot speak for yourself, that's where an advanced directive comes into play. And that's what we're going to talk about today. What are the advantages of having an advanced directive? Let me start before I say this. A show of hands, how many of you have an advanced directive filled out? Okay, now of you who raised your hand, how many of you feel like you have competently and clearly communicated those wishes to your family members or to your healthcare fire attorney? Pretty close to the thing. That's great. And that's really kind of the goal here. Now, if you didn't raise your hand, don't feel bad, because our goal today is to help you to start having those conversations, but also to facilitate that. Well, what are the advantages of having these? One, they allow you to exert the maximum amount of influence over your health care. They're also free. The reason we say that is that someone came up to me that first year when I had this conversation a lot, and I still have it regularly now, like today. And someone came up to me and said, "Rich, I'm glad you told me they're free. I just spent $3,000 on one." And I said, "Well, I bet you had an estate plan and a lot of other things attached to that." He's like, "Well, yes, I was sitting with my lawyer." We're not anti-lawyer. What we're trying to do is remove, if financial means is keeping you from filling out an advance directive, you need to recognize that the simplicity of the document itself can be written out and notarized and becomes a legal document. Now, if you are at a lawyer, doing an estate plan, to tack one of these on, the actual advanced directive, the living will piece, which we're going to look at the three different types of advanced directives, absolutely. Those documents can be notarized and taken care of if that's you. But there are a lot of folks who maybe have a wall there to say, "Well, I don't really have a lawyer," or maybe I don't even have an estate. I mean, we all have some things that we want to pass on, but to think we just want to remove that obstacle to people doing it. So we're going to talk about that as well. And the last advantage we're going to mention here is that they're a gift of a reduced burden to your loved ones. If you talk to anyone who's had to use them, and I've heard this firsthand in meetings like this, there are people who had them and who were so glad that they had them and communicated them. And those who did not have them but needed them wish they would have. And really, brass tacks, bare bones, gloves off kind of response is this, is that it doesn't matter what happens, but if a loved one is put in a place where they have to remove you off of a certain treatment, whether it's to take you off of a ventilator or to metaphorically unplug, well, inevitably family members feel they're the ones who are causing the death of that loved one. So when we talk about reducing the burden and it being a gift, we're letting them know our wishes in advance in a lot of different circumstances so that they know that they are now acting on your behalf at that point. And that's where the gift comes in. Because when these opportunities come, why place that burden on others where they feel like the weight of your life or death hangs in the balance in their decision? when these conversations are had in advance or they're written in detail, we understand and know. But how much more important, and we'll underscore this, is it to sit across the table from especially that one loved one, but the ones who are most likely needing to hear that, to know and to see it in your face, your expression of, this is what quality end of life looks like for me, if these scenarios take place. So it reduces the burden that's placed on family members so that we can help ease that stage of their life. Well, let's talk about types of advanced directives. And it's good that we're setting the table, and then we're going to kind of dig into this document that you picked up called the Five Wishes. There are three types of advanced directives. The first type of advanced directive is what we know to be a healthcare power of attorney. I like to say the healthcare power of attorney answers the who question. Who will speak for you and advocate for you that you've designated to make the most important decisions concerning your health care? Now, we believe this decision is the most important one to have for one main reason, is because if you don't have one today, and let's say that you know who the who needs to be, we're hoping that when you leave here today that you'll go talk to the who about the second one, which is the what. And that is what's traditionally known as a living will. And that includes what exactly you would want done or not done if you were unable to speak for yourself. There are instructions concerning your care, and they provide guidance regarding your philosophy. And I would underscore that word in your mind, because anytime we talk about philosophy of care, these are ideas and beliefs, especially about the types of care you need. Because while these, I believe, the most advanced directive or living will documents are very exhaustive, they'll give you a lot of scenarios, but when you can't speak for yourself, your healthcare power of attorney becomes you. And based on your wishes, they might not have an exact diagram that says if this, then this. But when you start to define philosophically what quality looks like, and again, regarding your particular wishes given certain circumstances. One thing to underscore about healthcare power of attorney, it's different than your durable power of attorney. That person has no ability to sell your property, to settle matters, dealing with finances in your estate. This person is only responsible for speaking to the doctor or doctors concerning healthcare decisions when you can't speak. So it's important to understand. We're going to dig into what those two look like here in a second, but just to understand the families of these. And the third family or type of advanced directive are those that are only done with your medical provider. The two main ones are the MOST form and the DNR. MOST is an acronym that stands for Medical Order for Scope of Treatment, and that is only done with a doctor. And it's only done in the face of a serious illness or an advanced stage of life when a person's facing that with the most form. The same is true about a DNR. DNR stands for, as you probably well know, is a do not resuscitate. Funny story. I work very closely as well with the church behind you at Cary Presbyterian. And we were doing a Sunday afternoon series of speakers, of which I was one, on advanced directives and end-of-life care, and there was multiple speakers. And the gentleman there was at an advanced stage of his life, but also facing the advanced stages of an illness. And he was a huge advocate for having your advanced directives, communicating them, and he talked about the DNR, and it made me laugh, because I used to make jokes about this, but he literally offered. He goes, look, I'm so passionate about it. He said, I had DNR tattooed to my chest. And he goes, and if anybody wants to see it, you don't believe me, meet me over here in the corner at the break. And I almost took him up on it. Now, I wouldn't say that that's the best type of document to have for DNR. But let me tell you also another story so you understand why these are important. We were asked, someone in our education department, by EMS workers at Wake Tech, it was over 400 of them, they asked us to come in to talk about the issues of DNRs as it relates to hospice patients. Okay? Because what happens? happens naturally for us. If we're visiting a loved one, regardless of where they're at in the stage of life, but especially at the end, and especially if they're in their hospice, and that person goes into a cardiac arrest, or something happens, what do? We're trained. Call 911. Well, the EMS workers were saying to us, when we get that call, and we all know, you know what I'm about to say, if you call 911, they have to do everything possible to save your life. And these are their words and not ours. If a person is in an advanced stage of an illness or an advanced stage of their life, and they don't have a DNR but they wanted one, the procedure itself is very traumatic. And they said this, quote, that the person you receive back after being resuscitated, again, advanced stage of life, advanced illness, their choice, and a doctor's, can end up in a much different state than when they went into that. So to understand, again, I'm 47 years old. I'm not going to put a DNR out there for myself or go work with my doctor because I want you to do whatever you can to resuscitate me, right? So it's not necessarily that you're here today, unless you're facing a serious illness and you're in your final 6 months or less to live, but to understand that is also, it's got some philosophy wrapped to it, but it's definitely something that needs to be communicated. And if you're at that stage of life, it has to be visible. EMTs know where to look when they come into a house, but typically in an assisted living facility or in a retirement home, it's either on the refrigerator or by the bed. It's a bright yellow document with a stop sign on it. And if it's not there and they're called, they'll do everything possible to save the person's life. The reason I share a little extra long on this is because they're important for us to understand the nature of, because some people, I've seen people show up with a set of most forms of DNRs. Unless you're at this stage, you don't need to concern yourself with it, but to understand that those things have to be communicated, especially to the people closest to you. But then that documentation in the right situation would need to be displayed or handed to an EMT when they come in. So those are the three types. Now we're going to get... Yes, sir.
I just want to mention one thing about the two forms. One of the Cary firefighters was doing some work at our house. It's his part-time job as a painter. And he mentioned that when they come into the house, they're going to look at the refrigerator. So I'm just adding to what was said here. But if you need to put them on the refrigerator, having had a parent in an assisted living facility also who was in failing health, I had told, knowing what they said about 911, I told them, I said, look, if there's a problem with mom, you call me. If 911 needs to be called, I'll call them, or in an emergency, you have to call them.
Right. So, right. Yeah, and I think everyone's story and everyone's circumstances that they're surrounded in is going to be a little unique depending on the distance from you and a family member, but to communicate clearly what those things are as well. And that's true about when we're going to now kind of dig down a little bit deeper into the first two types of advanced directives. Well, let me draw your attention to that blue document that you see, the Five Wishes document. We love this document for one main reason, is that if you actually can go to their website, and I'll tell you what it is, it's agingwithdignity.org, agingwithdignity.org. And I believe it's on the back of that Five Wishes document. They're based in Tallahassee, Florida. And the reason we love this document is because just like they say it is, it's really the heart and soul of a living will or an advanced directive. The reason being is that it actually goes into issues beyond what a traditional living will would do. And we're going to talk about the differences there. What's in this document is these documents, the Five Wishes type document, is legal in 42 states as an advanced directive or a living will, of which, of course, North Carolina is one of those. It contains, other than pieces beyond what's normally there, it contains everything that you find at the NorthCarolina.gov website on an advanced directive, except if you print it in, it's about 14 pages or more, and it's written in black and white, and it looks a little bit more, you know, legal in the sense of written by a lawyer. But the Five Wishes says the exact same thing. It is very, I say, user-friendly. And again, it prompts you to think about and ask questions about the same types of things that the Five Wishes does. We're going to get into just briefly just unpacking each of those wishes and why those are different. And let's say that you get to some of the others. You don't have to do, let's say, all five when we get to the last two pieces especially. But the healthcare power of attorney piece, the who, and the what, the traditional living will, I mean, you could stop at those two wishes if you don't go into those other details. This just puts it in a very simple format, easy language to start that conversation going. And we'll unpack this a little bit at a time as we go, okay? The first wish, and I said we'd come back to this, is the person that you want to make decisions for you according to your health care when you can't make them for yourself. And we mentioned health care proxy or power of attorney. You're allowed to name a person the name of the person who will make decisions for you. You can also name two alternates. And sometimes, you know, who we choose, and that's where we get down here to the next point, the person that we choose, we need to be careful that they will honor the wishes and, I guess, have enough backbone to stand up for you and your wishes. And I often tell this story, and it comes from others who have 30-plus years in the medical field and working in hospice, that they say it's at a stage of life or a person at the end of their life that typically, I mean, they literally had to almost break up fist fights of siblings over the bed of a loved one, a mother, because they differed in philosophy of care. One wanted the other, the mom wanted something different. And I like to share this illustration. You've heard it before, forgive me, but I think it's powerful because it helps me. It'll help you too, is this. I was in college and a gentleman was speaking and he held up a cup of water like this, and he had a pastor next to him on stage come up, and he shook his hand, had him shake his hand, and he shook his hand as hard as he could, and then water is going all over the stage and all over everybody near the stage. And I remember him looking at us, you know, everybody 150 college students, and he looked at us and he said, "This cup is like your life." He said, "When it's shaken, whatever's inside the cup is going to come out." And that stuck with me. And the reason I share that with you here is that when you receive a diagnosis, or a loved one does, that crisis and that diagnosis and that change of circumstances literally shakes our cup. It amplifies, magnifies, and exposes whatever's in our cup, our family cup, our individual cup. And that's good and bad. You know, if there are differences there and a loved one's dying, those come out. The good of people comes out. The bad, it just shakes us to our core because these are serious, life-changing issues. And the reason I say that is in those circumstances, why it's important at the stage you're at and I'm at to talk about your philosophy of care, who's going to direct that, the point we're talking about now, because they need to be able to stand up and say, "No, that's not what Mom wanted. That's not what Dad wanted." Not just in writing, but he looked me in the eye. We were designated this, that if this happened, you didn't want this to happen. Or if this happened, he said, "Do all these things," whatever those things are. So choosing that person, the right person could be, it's geographical. Who's most likely is, you know, we live in an age where we're separated from a lot of family. We move, we're pretty transient, or we're mobile. Who is most likely to be there closest that can speak for you or someone in your family if something were to happen. But also, either the right person who's best equipped to stand up and make a decision that may be unpopular if it was not communicated clearly. Essentially, as we mentioned, the healthcare agent interprets your instructions and makes decisions for you. And the legal requirements are simple. They have to be at least 18 years old. Now, I told you I have a 19-year-old and a 16-year-old. I don't think they're ready to direct my health care right now if something happens. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to speak up on that point where you're talking about protecting the person who has to make the decisions and choosing the right person. I'll be very interested when we get to talking about how to communicate to the broader family.
Okay.
Because that family strife legacy that is often left behind is... something many would rather avoid if they knew it could happen.
Absolutely. And we will. We will. That is definitely the nature. And why we love this document is because it actually, and we're going to talk about some creative and more positive ways to have that conversation or communicate those wishes. I appreciate you sharing that. The person can't be a healthcare provider or the spouse or employee of a healthcare provider. That's a person who can pay adequate attention to your needs. Why is that? Well, you don't want to put someone in a situation where they'd have a conflict of interest, like your doctor, someone at a facility where you're living. You know, I mean, who would potentially have a conflict of interest in keeping you alive? You know, that could be questioned. You know, it's like, well, I'm going to do everything possible, because obviously the implications of, you know, well, you keep them alive, they stay in our place, and they're just not in a position to do that. Of course, we'd hope that you trust them if that were the case, and you could, but it can't be someone in that circumstance, nor can it be your doctor. It doesn't have to be a family member. It could be a trusted friend. It could be a pastor. It could be whoever's closest and respected that can make that decision. But back to your observation, the who is one of the most important things too, but also communicating that, because depending on who the who is, it could, again, in all of our family dynamics are different. I mean, they're similar in many ways, but they're all unique. So just to know who that person is most important. So that's the who. The wish number one is the healthcare power of attorney. Wish number two is really what we refer to as the traditional living will. Now, it's okay if you use some of these interchangeably, but you won't have to after today, because you understand kind of where those are different. So if you said an advanced directive, or if you told someone you had a living will, and it included the healthcare power of attorney, people know what you're talking about. But for us to be specific, the second wish gets into the actual living will. It allows each person, you and I, to define what life support treatment means to you or to her. People may customize this definition and write on the blank lines. There are, in this document, places that you can add things or make changes in them. If you're like me and you probably scribble over things and mess things up, you can use this document as a template to transfer that to another document, if you'd like, and just type it yourself. I was so nervous when I started doing presentations on these because I was so fresh. And that same talk that I told you about, Cary Presbyterian behind us, there was a gentleman in the audience who was a retired lawyer. And I could tell he knew exactly. I mean, he'd probably forgotten more about law in the 30 minutes I was speaking than I would know in a lifetime. I mean, you could tell he was brilliant about the law. And he raised his hand to question something that I said. I was like, oh, great. I just completely blew it. Well, he said, Rich, not only do you not have to have it on this legal document and file away and with your attorney, he says, in reality, you can write it on a napkin, sign it, give it to your healthcare power of attorney, and designate them as that person. And I just kind of stood there and I said, I agreed with him to the extent that I said, obviously he knows more about the law than I do. But then I did feel freedom to add, that's not probably how I would execute that document or write it. But I think sometimes we look at a living will and we tend to think, you know, this is a document that's got to be, yes, notarized. It should be filed. It should be sent to some central location. Well, someone came up with that idea. And it's a great idea. Why don't we have a central place that you put your living will on the, you know, hospital or EMT can call it and find out what your wishes are. And we do have one of those. But guess what? It's password protected. So if you don't give someone your password, they can't look that up to find it out. Now, I'm not saying that that won't grow or develop over time, but I think the best case scenario is to make sure that the people closest to you know. I had a lady at Forest at Duke in Durham. We had a talk about these things. And she had witnessed, and a lot of folks do at the end of their life, people who had extraordinary measures taken to keep them alive, and they were not happy with the results. And I remember this lady looking at me almost with fear to say, I do not want what happened to my husband to happen to me? Or to my roommate in this facility to happen to me ever? And then she looked at me, she said, I'm about to go on a trip with my grandson. What do I do? I said, great question. I was like, why don't you just have a talk with him? Make sure whether it's in writing or he knows that if something were to happen, this is my exact express wish. The fact that it was so close to her and important, I just wanted to give her a practical solution. So let's say your healthcare power of attorney is staying here in Cary and you're going on a trip. You know what? Say, I know this sounds weird for me to tell you this, but part of my story is I've witnessed this, and here are my wishes, and just know that if this happens, you can call whoever you need to, but just make sure as you're talking to the doctor for me, again, then leave it. That's a lot of burden to put on a grandchild, maybe, but in her case, she looked at me, and she said, that's a good idea. Put it in your glove box. Just tell him it's there if you don't want to tell him what's in it. Whatever it is that eases that conversation for both parties, let's make sure that happens. Because these are real inherent fears of what could happen. So, moving on. So you can add or make changes in the document. Let me add this as well. This document, we say it's free. We do purchase these five wishes documents. That's part of what we like to give out. They're like $1. And the only reason I say that is just so you know, when I say they're free, okay, so they're $1. Okay, you get them notarized. All right, so if a notary is not a friend, then they charge you to notarize each signature. There's not an exorbitant fee attached to it. On their website, agingwithdignity.org, there is an electronic version of this document. It does cost a little more. It's like $5. But it's one that you can type it into. You can update it regularly, make changes when you need to. A lot of people have asked that, and I'm glad. So if that's something that's helpful to you, there's another way in order to do that. But that's a great website. What is the living will? These are general instructions for healthcare providers and caregivers. It includes providing medicine for pain. It gives you different scenarios in terminal conditions. If you were in a coma, if you had severe brain damage, it also gives you space to write additional instructions based on your personal beliefs and philosophy. As you can imagine, because we're in a church, I speak to a lot of churches. When I go to Catholic churches have very specific advanced directives and living wills that are particular. And here's where I reassured them before presenting at a lot of the Catholic Church we have good relationship with is that these documents, the five wishes especially, they're not telling you what to decide. You ingrain your philosophy, your beliefs, I would say your theology, as it applies to life and the measures that you want taken to keep you alive and those that you do not want. So they're not directing you in a particular way. But I know with the Catholic Church, they're very specific and particular about issues relating to life, end of life, and all life, that they actually provide for their parishioners, if requested, certain documents that are very Catholic specific. So whatever beliefs or philosophy you have, to make those a part of your wishes is very simple. But what it will give you directions is, hold up in this case. What measures would you want taken and not taken? So that document, those things can be added or changed. Because there's nothing you have to change that says, well, hold on, it was worded this way, I want to cross that out and say don't. No, it'll ask you as you go into that document to see, given in this situation, whether it's hydration, whether it's artificial feeding tube, and again, under different circumstances and situations. Now, I tell people, we tell people, you don't have to be a doctor or lawyer to figure these out. But if there are things you don't understand going from here today, it's okay to sit down with a pastor, with a doctor or nurse, with a lawyer, if you're working through that. But to get advice and insight before you write the documents out. Yes, sir.
Some of us actually have a thumb drive on us that have complex medical studies and so on and so forth. So if you always wear that, reducing these documents, even the notarized versions of them, to PDFs, do they have the same effect as the actual document? Would they be respected by whomever?
Right.
If you had DNRs the most.
Right. So if you had those notarized and then put in PDF?
Yes.
I believe so. Because what happens today with most notaries, and I went through the notary process just to have it. It's not that I execute a lot of these documents or help people. It's just wanted to have that. But I found out even in notary class, not a lot of notaries have even the raised seal on type stamps. So when it's stamped, sealed with that person's commission and signing on there, it's a legal document. I mean, I think it'd be wise to give the original, if you'd like, to your healthcare power of attorney. But I've been told you can make mass copies of this. Now, electronically, I think it's great. I mean, I even have my insurance card for my car, my truck, on my phone. Like, I need to go print a new one, so I have a paper copy. I mean, people validate that as being a legitimate copy. I would say make sure, you know, again, that notary's signature and seal is there. I think it is. Because that's the first time I was asked that question about the electronic piece, I'd like to validate that further. But I know the spirit of this, legally, because of the type of document we're looking at, I think it's okay for you to utilize that. So it's a good question. Let's keep moving, because we're going to actually have time. We're going to add, and there's others who want to add some additional resources that we've talked about before coming in that can possibly help you. The third wish of the five wishes has to do with comfort measures. As you can imagine, I tell people jokingly that, as I told you, my background was not in anything health or medical. So I tell people this often that I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I'm not the butter knife either. So I knew where to find a dictionary when it came to understanding what it is that we did, because the word palliative kept coming up all the time. I was like, what does palliative mean? And how does that connect with hospice care? And you're probably asking, what does that have to do with this point? Well, the Latin word pallium, which is where we get the word palliative from, means to cloak. So imagine on a cold day, not like today, but on a cold day, someone were to wrap a nice, warm, handmade quilt around you. That is to cloak you with that warmth and with that blanket. Well, comfort measures, hospice and palliative care, they're both the same type of medical subspecialty. Just like you go to a cardiologist for your heart. What palliative care does is it wraps and cloaks a person with comfort and not necessarily working towards cure. Now, a person can have palliative care and still work towards a cure. But when a person goes on hospice proper, a six-month diagnosis, given the doctor's best estimation, doesn't mean you have to in 6 months, but a person qualifies at that point and they realize that the curative treatments are futile. They're just not working. But a person can have that same type of care, that comfort cloaked around them while they're working towards a cure and even when they're under hospice proper. The reason I say that is this third wish talks about comfort measures for you. And it's not just medicinal, but it's also other things. How comfortable do you want to be? We all know the 0 to 10 scale. If you walked into the emergency room today with pain, they say on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being the worst pain you've ever felt, where's your pain? And you know the only way to get seen then is to say 10 or 9. Right? To which they won't believe you, but no, they will. It's the same concept with pain and symptom management and how comfortable you want to be. I was told, again, by those in the medical field, that there are ways for them to gauge a level of pain or comfort for a person, even when they can't speak for themselves. Now, I cannot detail you today what that looks like from a layman's perspective, but the way you designate this here is to say this is, hey, look, if I'm at a place I can't speak for myself, I do want to be comfortable. I don't want to be noticeably in pain. But I can handle being at a 5 as long as I can be a little bit more aware of what's going on around me to the degree that I can. Some would say, you know what? I want to be completely sedated. I don't want to feel a thing. I don't care to know anything that's going on. I just don't want to be in pain. To somebody who may say, again, their beliefs or their personal desires, I don't want any of that. So, I mean, again, it's your wishes. So we express that here because if, as you discover more about hospice care and palliative care, it's also a place where you can let your loved ones know who may not know as much as you do about hospice, who maybe still equate hospice with death and dying. It's like, well, if you call them, it's over. We're giving up. It's all done. When really you're talking about another layer of support to help you and to help them so they can free them up to be the spouse, the son, the daughter, you know, the friend, and not have to worry. So again, you let that wish be known. It's not saying we're, you know, this particular hospice in this particular situation, but say it's okay to call hospice. It's okay, because I understand they're going to bring measures of comfort. Even down to the types of care you know, that you wish to have, even the minor things. So let's talk about the fourth wish. The fourth wish is how you want people to treat you. This is what others should keep in mind if you become seriously ill. And it can be something as simple as whether you want to have people around you or hold your hand. I often tell people this, as we age or as we get sick or as we're surrounding anything to be at the end of life, it doesn't matter what your age is, child, teenager, anyone, we don't know how to act around people who are dying or facing death, and in many cases, people who are just aging, let alone even just sick. And so we don't know what to say, we don't know what to do, we kind of avoid it. Even our culture, I think, dealing with death and dying, our culture, many of you and I as well can recall days where, I mean, we're used to seeing death a little bit closer. And that doesn't mean like daily, like you're in the field of caring for those who are dying, but you know, for people to go to a funeral, to see an open casket, or to have someone cared for in their home, we kind of insulate, and I understand why, different generations, we insulate them away from having to look at it and to feel it. I'm not saying morbidly, I'm just saying to understand that it is a stage of life. So the reason I say that is, if you would communicate some of this to the people, again, I don't envision you having this conversation today with your grandkids, but what I'm trying to say is that in that circumstance, if that person who's tending to you and they're coming in, it's okay for them to say to kids, grandkids, family members, say, you know what, one thing they made sure to tell me is I want you to just, they're still here. They're still, and, you know, he actually said he wanted us to hold his hand, read some scriptures, read a poem. I literally heard a lady say, I'm not making this up, she wanted Elvis Presley to play it in her room. And it's like, all right, that's what you want? Great. Pictures of family members. Something that, again, didn't make death and dying or sickness or illness or that advanced stage of life. So, I don't. It's obviously a difficult stage of life for anyone to have to approach when someone reaches that. But to give people permission ahead of time and to have someone there facilitating that. I've had that happen at funerals when I was young. You know, a grandmother, a mom and a trusted aunt who said, it's okay. Do you want to walk up to the casket and see your grandfather? Okay, I'll do that with you. You know, but I imagine when people are sick, even just, I remember doing early visitations. You know, I say visitations as a child. You go into a sick person's bed. It's like, God, what do I say? What do I do? It's okay. Just go, you know, we're just going to talk and we'll pray for them. You're just going to just be there. You know, and I think we just want to ease that, okay? And now we get to the fifth wish. So when we talk about this particular document being kind of the heart and soul of the living will, this is where this one, I want to tell you on a personal level, this fifth wish, at the time when I started this job a little over 3 years ago, I tell people we had a Henry Ford approach to doing community engagement and education. That meant, you know, Henry Ford made the Model T and he said, you can have that in black. Or a darker shade of black. It's like, one choice. Well, that's kind of what we did. We love going out just talking about hospice care in our organization. We'd love to. But because people equated that, now we're pushing, with death and pushing so far away. When we had this conversation, that's part of the reason we're doing this today. But when we got to this fifth wish of doing this with thousands of people, I started to recognize this is really where we should start that conversation. And that's when we started going out and changing the subject to say, what is it you want your life to count for? Very much a ministry approach. It's like, well, we know our time is limited, but what are we going to do with the time that we have? Well, what matters the most? One of those books that launched from this fifth wish was a book called The Four Things That Matter Most. And that was written by a hospice and palliative care specialist, Dr. Ira Byock. 30 plus years, lessons he learned about death and dying from those who were living. Flip that around. Lessons he learned about living from those who were dying. The patients he was caring for, their families. He found four things people needed to communicate before they passed. And those four things weren't things at all. They're relationships. And they were, I forgive you. Will you forgive me? Thank you. And I love you. Expressions of forgiveness, closure, both giving and receiving. Expressions of gratitude for those who imparted things into our lives and built us up. And expressions of love, communicating that. So this fifth wish deals with closure matters and unfinished business. So let's say regardless of where you're at in your life and diagnosis or people around you, there's nothing to say that today, if you're not already, I hope you are, keeping short accounts on the unfinished business. People who you need to forgive. People you need to ask forgiveness from. People who you want to express thanks to and who want to share your love with because they mean so much to you. It encourages us here to express matters of deep importance in an age where families, as we mentioned, live apart. It allows us to offer that love and forgiveness and communicating the practical matters, preferences of memorials and burials. And part of the reason I say that is inevitably in a lot of churches I've spoken in, especially on Sundays, oftentimes there's a pastor or clergyman in the back, and I've had one lady ran to the front and said, please do that. Please tell us what we have. We have documents. We want you to start telling us what your wishes are, even for memorials and burials and things that matter. And again, these are for people who are in church, who are regular there, their pastors want to care for them and honor them, and people keep those on file, and it helps their job. It helps them honor you and your wishes. Yes, sir.
Who was the author of that book?
His name is Ira Byock.
Spell the last
name. B-Y-O-C-K. Ira Byock. I told you a little bit about my family, and we went through a lot going from Malaysia to here. Really terrible reentry. It was harder coming back than it was to leave. We came into some economic uncertainty and our plans kind of crashed. Well, after doing a lot of these presentations, I started to think we got back. I just said, I just feel like I wanted to communicate some things that meant a lot to me, to my kids. Not that I was dying or facing death, but and I'm not shy, obviously. It's easy for me to use words and I can tell them and I know they feel loved. But I thought, I'm just going to write some things down. And I really felt prompted this one day. And I wrote them about four relationships that changed my life. I told them a story about, when I was 17 years old. You may or may not believe this, but I got kicked out of high school. I failed 23 classes. I made 19 D's. I was a stellar high school student. I came back, and I was really too far behind to try to graduate, so I ended up dropping out. But in the middle of that, when I was in a very difficult time in my life, I got invited to breakfast, and of all places, I walked into a Wendy's restaurant, and it was that day that I came to faith in Christ, and God radically changed my life. And I walked out the other side of that door a changed person. Not more religious, not better, not a better form of me, but a brand new person. I haven't shut up talking about it since then. It's been almost 30 years. And I shared that in a letter to my kids. They knew the story, but I wanted them to know that's one. I told them about the day, second, that I met their mom, who I've been married to for 23 years. I thought about how beautiful she looked. I remember the first time I saw her. She was my best friend. That was it. I thought it was all it was going to be, but I ended up marrying the homecoming queen because I stayed just close enough. And we were good friends. I told them about how that changed my life. Then I told them about when they were born. And my first, when I had a daughter. For men, a daughter changes a man's life, you know, because I all of a sudden get a little bit more backbone and throw their shoulders back and they're a little tougher, you know. They start dealing with firearms and chainsaws and big, they try to get bigger and scare away all the suitors, right? So, no, I just felt like, okay, I've got to protect and care for my daughter. But then I had a son. And I had a son, I got worried because I said, oh, no, he's going to be just like me. And he is. He's not getting kicked out of high school. But he is in so many ways. So it changed. So every relationship, everything in those letters, in one letter, changed my life. And I remember having this talk the first time I shared that part of my story with downtown Raleigh in a church at First Baptist. And this lady looked at me and I saw her hand go up. She said, what did you do with the letter? And I said, I'm glad you asked. I printed them as soon as I finished it. I made copies for each one of them. And I went home and I gave it to them. I didn't wait and see them read it. I didn't ask them later what they thought about it. I just gave it to them. Because for me, at my stage of life, I just wanted to practically cultivate that so they know how important they are to me. And I need to keep doing it. That doesn't mean it's over. But I wanted to practice that. And the reason I share that is, regardless of where you're at in your life, I'm not here today to try to get your vote for Father of the Year and Husband of the Year, okay? Because I actually had a very bad Valentine's a week ago. I could have done a lot better. but it's not that. But it's just to say it's that easy. It's that simple. And then how do we do that? Sometimes a creative way to leave a legacy, again, based on these five wishes, use this as a catalyst. Write those letters to your loved ones and encourage and communicate how much they mean to you. It doesn't have to be as drippy and as sappy as my sound did. It really wasn't that much. It was just dad, matter-of-fact, saying, I just want you to know you're important, and here's why. You changed my life. Thank you for coming into my life. Another thing to do is write out your beliefs. It's called an ethical will. I'll make it real simple for you. Take a blank sheet of paper and just write the words, I believe, and start writing. It's not necessarily a doctrinal statement. You can include theology in there. What are some of your life lessons? It'll be amazing what stories come along with those life lessons. And imagine passing that ethical will. Maybe even start talking about it. Rather than, we're not talking about something you roll up and tuck away in a time capsule. When you die, they pull it out. Start having those talks around the table. You know, I was thinking about this ethical will thing. It's this concept and a list of I believes. What do you guys think? What do you believe? I'll tell you, I know what Dad stood for. I know what Mom believed. And again, not just believe faith. That is, to me, very much tantamount, most important. But believe about life, about living, about how to do it, how to love, how to forgive, how to express thanks. Modeling that for them. I heard a great story of someone at a family reunion. And these days, as you guys know, probably in your pocket you have a phone, a smartphone, or you at least have a tablet or a computer that has more technology than when they launched, you know, went to the moon with the first rocket, right? So imagine if the next time you're all gathered at a fun family function, if you passed that phone around and you just went around, this is what these people did. They just told stories. Stories about how couples met, funny things that happened on vacation, things that were part of their heritage. Because sometimes when you think about writing them, it gets kind of, it's kind of tedious. Now I have to sit down and read it. But as they sat around a fire, even from the oldest to the youngest, they would just each tell a story. And they kept it documented. Or they just did it personally and had that documented for them. So different creative ways to do that. Audio recording or video. Start writing journals of stories from your life to be given to your family. But you know, just like living will or an advance directive, you don't want to tuck it away and put it in the safe deposit box where nobody can find it. This is all about right here, right now, cultivating this kind of lifestyle. And again, just continuing to pass on that type of legacy for your family. So the document itself, let's say you complete it and have it notarized. And we are going to come to your question. I'm going to give you one creative way that I think would help. have that conversation, and then we can open it up and talk about others. Let's say you complete the document, you get it signed, get it notarized. Now what do? Just like I just alluded to, you can't use what you can't find, or that's password protected, that no one knows where to get it. So what do? Just remember, give and keep. What do you want to do? You want to give a copy, obviously, to your healthcare power of attorney, the WHO. Give a copy to your doctor, healthcare providers, who would, let's say, most likely be there if something were to happen. But of course, there are those scenarios, right, where, let's say, emergency room or something happened and no one was around, you know, to let people know your records or somehow call this person. There's a related document to that. Give a copy of these if you live in a facility. Assisted living, skilled nursing, just retirement home, neighborhood, someone close by, if you're tied in your church, it's important. And give a copy to your loved ones. Well, what do you keep? Keep a copy in your home where it's easily accessible, but also keep a list of who you give them to. Why is that important? Because you can make changes and make changes very easily. We tell people, review it every time you get a deed. If you're one of those, and obviously most of you have them, every decade, if you haven't thought about it in 10 years, hopefully you have. If there's been a divorce in the family, if there's been a death of a loved one, again, these are just little reminders to just help you think about it. And they're natural triggers that kind of help us process our own things. If there's a change in diagnosis or a decline in health status, and all of those make sense when you think about it, right? If you go through a divorce and your spouse was your healthcare power of attorney, you might not want them making decisions for you. If someone died who was your healthcare power of attorney, obviously you need that key one person to make that choice speak for you. And those things are important. All you have to do, the reason you keep a list of who you gave them to, is you gather all of those back and you destroy them and you distribute the new copies. Again, notarized and then copied. You don't have to notarize every copy, but get the key one done, notarize it, and then give the other people the copies of those who need them. Now, this is kind of where we get in, to the gentleman's question earlier about having these conversations and family situations where you know there are people who aren't ready to have this talk, let's say. And there are a lot of them. And regardless of if you're facing illness or not. But here's one, I say this is a creative suggestion. There are a lot of, but this will just get us started on this, okay? Because maybe some of you have had those, but one I like to share is based on creating this creative legacy. You know, we tell people, well, obviously, Thanksgiving, Christmas, that's a good time to talk turkey, right? Not just literal turkey. It's when families gather. Now, what am I not saying? I'm not saying at the table when you're carving the turkey and you're like, hey, I want to tell you guys something. Here's what happens. If I were to die, or if I was not be able to speak right now, that's not what we're saying, all the kids and grandkids, Christmas or Thanksgiving. But imagine this. Imagine if in your family, I'm going to say hypothetical, it's you, so you have three kids. Two of them can handle having that talk. One of them will run the other direction. Imagine if you just had this talk, though, and you said to them this. Look, all I want to say is this. I want to give you one. This is a copy of kind of my wishes if something were to ever happen, as far as medical treatment, in case I can't speak for myself. I've designated your sister, your brother. They're going to speak for me. No decisions have to be made by the whole group. They know what my wishes are. I want you to have a copy, but because I know this is hard for you, I've also included a letter for you. It's just from me to you. And that's kind of a gift of Christmas. This is a gift of Thanksgiving or your birth, whatever it is. And I just want you to just know how much I love you, how much you mean to me. But I know this is hard to talk about, but you need to know for me, I need, maybe not need to talk to you about it, but I need you to know what's in the letter, but also in that document. Okay? It's hard to deal with, but if you got any questions, you know I want to talk to you. But to me, due diligence is just to talk about to you. Now, the hardest work is the hard work. You know, it's getting this stuff done and doing it. And there's a continual tension on doing the heart side of this as far as communicating matters of importance. The documents themselves, if you know what you want, you don't have it, you can fill those out in no time. All right, you may want to process a few things deeper, but you're not going to necessarily do it today in this meeting. But they can be done very quickly, notarized and copied. It's the other piece that gets cultivated. So I think, again, according to family dynamics, it all depends on what's the easiest way to strategically say, this person doesn't even, would walk out of the room if I pulled all five of us together because they know something was coming. So maybe that's a one-on-one over coffee. Hey, let's go grab lunch or let's get coffee. And that's all you say is, here's something for you. Well, what is this? I know, I'm coming, but there's this, and this is a gift for you. Now, again, it's kind of a touchy-feely way to do it for those who you know will run the opposite direction. But there are probably other creative ways. And I think because we're kind of towards the end of the formal things, other than questions, I say let's springboard off of the next question. Have anyone of you here had to have difficult conversations with your family members? And maybe had one that was difficult to talk about, too. Anybody?
Well, this is a long time ago, actually. My mother died relatively young, and there were five of us in the family that were the siblings, you know. And she had only spoken to one of us about what she wanted with regard to her care in the end, and none of the other brothers and sisters believed that. And it could not be executed because they, you know, you couldn't do it. So I think that if you talk to one, you've got to talk to everyone.
That's good wisdom. Anybody else have a story?
I was just going to echo that because my parents are, or my dad passed away a couple of years ago. My mom's 90 now. And, you know, when we got to a certain age, we actually asked them, what are your wishes? And they didn't want to talk about it. You know, they just really did not want to talk about it. They didn't want to talk about it with each other, and they didn't want to talk about it with us. But then when my dad passed away, then my mom started talking to us about what her wishes are. Or so it's I think it's hard for everybody involved.
Yeah.
And what I think creates the tension at the end is when people don't know what your wishes are, and then the kids are left with conflict amongst themselves because they can't agree.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes it takes the right, depending on how size the family, it's the right sibling having that one talk with a very simplified, let's say using a document like this, just to start the conversation. Like, my mom, we don't know. You know, but it's interesting what happens, though. You're right, when death happens in the family, we don't want to talk about death and dying and the end of a person's life because we're fearful and we're very superstitious, many of us, if we're honest, because it's like, well, if we talk about death, something's going to happen. I'm not saying everyone thinks that way, but there's times people avoid it because it's like, I don't want to deal with it. Not necessarily superstitious, like I'm going to make it happen. Folks just don't like talking about it. But, yes, sir?
I've had two M's to your D's, marriage and move.
Yeah.
The modern phenomenon, the blended family, I echo the sentiments. I was one of four siblings that had the same conflict. But now you have adult children of a new spouse who legitimately often may feel that they have a greater say in such matters than a new spouse.
Right. And I would say if you're the parent, the ball's really in your court or you're steering the ship. I mean, if you're here, and that's why I asked those two questions. Do you have one? Okay. And have you communicated it clearly? Well, let's expand it one third layer further. Do all the people who need to know, who would be most affected by what your wishes are? That's where I say it's like kids and grandkids. You want to let them all know how much you love them and their relationships. And start leaving a legacy before you even know you're going. Honoring the people who honored you and blessed you in your life, and them especially. But who's most likely to overreact or underreact or have a bad reaction? And that's hard for us, you know. But only you know your family dynamic. So I think strategically it's important to make that list and kind of prayerfully look through how to proceed. Yes, ma'am.
I think it helps. I have a daughter who's dog or and a son, and I know because when my parents passed that my son is not able to handle the medical stuff. He can handle the financial, and I talk to my kids. So my daughter's going to handle the medical decisions, and she knows what I want. My son will handle the financial. I think it's important to talk to your kids and find out what they're capable of handling, how they feel about it, and let them know. And I mean, it's all out there.
Let me add this as a resource, and actually I need to probably just tweak and add some things to what we have here today. There are actually two different separate movements, and they have the same wording, one of the same word in there. And it's, one is begin the conversation, and one is the conversation project. Okay, conversation project. What those two types of websites and nonprofits do is they give you more ideas about how to creatively have these talks. Because it really is about having that conversation. Because again, if something's legal, black and white, and you just drop it off and say it's in there, it's a much different thing to realize there's a way to cultivate a better closure. And that actually could help in your legacy, being one, you know, sometimes our last thoughts about people, you know, and our last connections are the ones that we carry with us. Of course, we have all maybe good memories from the past, or maybe they're bad memories from the past, but all of a sudden we start to cultivate toward the end of our life or a disease, we start to cultivate a more positive legacy, one maybe more so reconciliation, joy rather than pain. And imagine if those stories aren't shared or those conversations aren't had. Again, we could possibly put a burden on people when really we don't want them feeling like that. I've had people pass in my family who left things well, and I don't mean well like they left a lot of money. They left things well where it wasn't hard. And there's others who left, and we had to just plow through everything for over a year. You know, where did this go? Where did that go? Now that's a state too, but also more so with those things. Like, why did you burden us with those decisions and choices? You might not say it out loud, but you're feeling it's like, I can't believe I had to make that choice. I didn't know. And then again, if you have two siblings and one said, this is what he said he wanted, now it's like he took his life. I mean, there's just a lot of strange dynamics that can be circumvented to the best that you have the power to do. There's no, here's three easy steps to communicating with your family, you know, but again, it's you and I'm learning how to navigate those relationships.
Yeah, a caveat about apportioning the medical part versus the financial part or whatever. You know, the myth about apples don't fall far from the trees, that is total myth. I've seen it in way too many families, including my own. Five of us came from exactly the same trees, and we could not be more diametrically opposites than God knows what. But if everybody doesn't know the wishes, your wishes, especially among multiple children, then when the really, really, really tough medical choices are put before you and you say, do it or not do it, there are always going to be dissenters. Mm-hmm. And that dissension, yeah, in my family, that dissension cost 20 years of bad blood. You know, but things get crazy.
They do.
And things get tough.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I try to put a disclaimer and say there's no simple, you know, three-step book that's going to make everything work out wonderfully in your family if to have this conversation. There are lessons to learn from others who've gone through it. Family divided, you know, or affected 20 years running over it, to where how do you help navigate your loved ones around you through that if it happens, that when it happens, in a way that you can remove as many of those stumbling blocks or obstacles. You're not going to remove them all, I don't think. I think I hear what you're saying, but
I think five wishes, if I could interrupt. Yeah. I think if my mother had executed one of these, mm-hmm. and we all had it,
right.
then we would know right. what page she was on.
Exactly.
All of us would know exactly
her
intent.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
One thing I wanted to mention, my dad did, I thought was good. So in today's age, people think about their directives and things, and they're in the safety deposit box or in a safe or on the internet or wherever. But my dad had a little green tackle box, like he used in fishing, except he used for paperwork. So he had some important papers there. And in that tackle box was kind of a one-page list of things to do. And so, for example, it wasn't a lot of emotional stuff. It had, okay, well, I want a Catholic mass. He was Catholic. I want you to give the priest $100. And I want you to do this or that. Just some very practical things. But the mental image of the tackle box was a helpful thing because it was a tangible place. Because when you think about a safety deposit box, I mean, that's...
Somebody has to have a key to that. You know, because everybody's journey and their story and their family dynamics are all going to be different, it's finding your tackle box. It's finding ways to have this conversation, whether it's together, which is a whole different group dynamic to try to navigate. So maybe if you wanted to do it together, that you had someone else there to help facilitate it, a trusted pastor, friend, who's got the skills of being able to communicate that. It's really why for us, we not just for conversations like this, but we have a team of social workers. I think sometimes we look at social workers and we're thinking about situations with kids and homes and situations, but to have a social worker at a hospital or at a hospice or in a facility, wherever it is, someone, let's say not necessarily just a social worker in our context, yes, but in your family dynamic, someone to help facilitate that conversation. Because if you're part of the conversation, if you're part of the issue, we all know each other in the family too well. And then all this other stuff comes up. But if someone's facilitating it, trusted, you know, who knows when to pull back. This isn't an announcement. This isn't hashing these things out. But can just get that piece of business started talking about, that's a way. And that's where our social workers come in with us. When they start to get into advanced care planning, the diagnosis has obviously now changed because they're with us at the different stages I described to you. They have access to that. But you have access. When you think about, you got to think about your resources. Who do you have in your family, human resources? Meaning, you know what? Dad's best friend, Bob. Everybody loves him. We call him Uncle Bob. You know, like, you know, he's family. Or you know what? Everybody respects the pastor on this one. We're gonna have, I don't know who that person is, but I have a facilitator, you know, to be there. Not formal. Somebody comfortable. You know, who knows and can feel the feeling in the room and can help that conversation. So I think it's really up to us to know how's the best way to have that. For me, like I said, you know, 47, I just started cultivating some of those conversations deeper. You know, and you know, some of your wishes too. We talked about beliefs and philosophies. You know, there are folks who say, don't do anything extraordinary to keep me alive because quality of life is not being hooked up to a machine. And yet part of your philosophy of care may be, you know what, I just trust. Whether it's by God's hand and doing a miracle or whether it's through some scientific breakthrough. Exhaust every option to the last degree. But here's my tipping point. I don't want to be in this much pain. I don't want to be kept alive. Or keep me in a state like this long enough in this scenario to where family members can come and be there if they'd like. You know what I'm trying to say? So it's not like you're saying we're going to keep them on for 6 months, a year, you know, artificial. But again, I can't inject, you know, or project what yours should be, but there are a lot of scenarios. But I like the tackle box analogy. I think that's a great one to walk. Find your tackle box. Know your family dynamic, and start having those conversations. You wanted to add something earlier when we met, and I've already shared it with a few people just in passing. I think it's important just to share the resource.
My name is Bill Godetti. I'm a parishioner here, and I think many of you know about the Center for Emotional Healing, and they've asked me to do a seminar on ways to reduce financial stress in your life. And so I will be doing that seminar. Also, I've promised people like Beth and the adult education things that if anybody wants a financial plan done, I will do one. It's all pro bono, no dollars, no nothing. And so I just wanted to make that offer.
Thank you. And we met before, but he reminded me coming in, I think that's just appropriate to know that whether this church is home for you or not, but to know that you've got someone in your community who said, I'm willing to help you. Because maybe that's one of the, it is an issue. I mean, there's the medical and then the relational and that dynamic, but then there's that financial piece to just even know, yeah, a roadmap of at least what are the things I need to get, you know, straightened out. Sometimes for many of us, is if we have an estate plan, we have some things that we know we make sure secure. Typically, we get to a certain place in life where we're processing those because those are valuables. We counter, not counter is not the right word. We want to complement that way of thinking is to say, you know, that book, The Four Things That Matter Most, the doctor will sell, would tell you, and most would. You ask someone who's being wheeled in for a third week, a third round of chemotherapy, or he or she's nearing the end of their life, what matters the most to them right then? It's always people. It's relationships that matter. Now, granted, it's wonderful if you leave your financial house in order, regardless of what you leave behind, but you leave your paperwork in order, and it's easy. But I'm telling you, it's the heart things that we live with the longest. And remember that. It's the heart work that's the hard work. But it's worthwhile because those things will travel with us.